From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in 1992 when New York State heard the first iteration of a proposal for single-payer health care. And for almost 30 years, the New York Health Act has been proposed in some form or another, never passed into law. Generally speaking, Republicans have opposed it, and Democrats have been divided. Former New York State Assembly Majority Leader Joe Morelli argued that this is an issue that should be taken up on the federal level only. He did not support the state version of single-payer health care. But now advocates are hoping that this time it's different. Democrats have full control over state government, essentially. And next week, the Senate holds a hearing on single-payer. With Republicans controlling the Senate and the presidency and the federal level, no one expects Medicare for All to pass anytime soon in Washington. But states like New York could forge ahead with their own versions. And this hour, a debate over the merits of single-payer health care in the New York Health Act. The business community in particular has routinely opposed single-payer. That doesn't mean all businesses, of course. It does mean leadership organizations, and you're going to hear from a couple this hour. Supporters counter that American health care is expensive, inefficient, and the status quo is unsustainable. So let's talk about it, and we'll welcome our guests in studio for the hour. Mike Sportello is co-chair of the Rochester Campaign for New York Health. Mike, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, who is a retired pediatric cardiologist and also with the Campaign for New York Health. Doctor, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
With us here in studio is Greg Barilla, the state director of NFIB. That's the National Federation of Independent Businesses. Greg, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan.
And on the line with us is Michael Crocker, executive director of Unshackle Upstate. Michael, welcome. Thanks for taking the time.
Greetings from the Southern Tier.
From the Southern Tier. It's good to have you. I didn't know where you'd be calling from. So we've got guests with different perspectives and listeners. We will take your phone calls and emails if you want to share them as we go throughout the hour. But I want to let our guests kind of give you some of their opening views on the question of single payer at the state level as we move into next week and the Senate hearing. I'll start with Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, I want to start off with a story. I have the privilege of working in clinics across Rochester and the Monroe County area. And the other week, I had the opportunity to see a little girl. This girl was suffering at school because of some stuff going on at home, and the teacher agreed, and the doctor agreed, and I agreed, and the dad agreed. This little girl, she needed to go to counseling. This would be really good for her. She needed this. But because of the high deductible plan that she was on, she was actually unable to go. Her dad was not able to afford the high cost of somebody that had insurance to give this little girl what she actually needed to be healthy, to be able to succeed in school. We all know that health impacts everything in life. And for this little girl, we weren't able to make ends meet for her that day because of the high cost of the high cost of that therapy. So right now in New York State, even if you're insured, it's affecting our children. It's affecting our families. And that's why we need the New York Health Act.
Okay. Dr. Ray Ellen Cavey, go ahead.
Well, I would just chime off of what Mike said, which is that the average health care cost in this country is twice, as a percentage of GDP, is twice what it is in other countries that have a nationally insured health care plan. And just relative to the deductibles question that Mike brought up, there's been a 220% increase over the last 10 years in the deductibles that people pay, while wages have gone up a total of 10%. So those are huge cost increases. And I just want one more thing.
Yeah.
Those are not balanced by the level of health care that we should have. We have the lowest life expectancy of any of the industrialized nations. We have the highest infant mortality and close to the highest maternal mortality. So although we're spending a great deal of money, we don't have the outcomes we need.
Dr. Cavey, you're only going to hear Michael Crocker if you get those headphones on. So grab those, and I'll turn to Greg Barilla first, his thoughts on the New York Health Act and what we're going to see debated next week.
Well, thank you, Evan.
And get even a little closer to the mic there. Go ahead, Greg.
I am the state director for NFIB, as you mentioned, National Federation of Independent Business. We represent about 10,500 independent businesses, small businesses across the state. The average size of our members, 9 to 11 employees. They are exactly the type of small businesses you see in your communities, restaurants, hardware stores, mechanics. That's an NFIB member. And small businesses like these have significant concerns about the New York Health Act. And I'm glad that my partners here today brought up cost. Because we do spend too much in this state. It does cost too much in this country. We have concerns about the cost of insurance, but there are unprecedented costs associated with this bill. This bill, one estimate, would add $310 billion in additional state costs. That would be paid for by around $190 billion in new state taxes. Who is going to pay these? How are we going to afford this? From my members' perspectives, it will largely fall upon the backs of businesses. And what does that mean? That means they have to reduce costs in other areas. Maybe they move out of state. These are real, real concerns in a state that already struggles to attract and grow businesses. And we're in a region right here in Rochester, in upstate New York, that struggles even more.
Michael Crocker, what do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So as you mentioned at the beginning, I represent Unshackle Upstate. Unshackle Upstate is an upstate-focused business advocacy coalition advocating on behalf of taxpayers across upstate New York. And when you look at that region in particular, by really any measure, we are losing. We've lost a million people in the state of New York over the last 10 years. We lost 50,000 in just the last year. And I believe the New York Health Act will exacerbate a lot of those problems. I think we can all support expanding access to coverage and making health care more affordable. I just don't believe that the New York Health Act is the most responsible and affordable way to do that. I don't think that the plan does anything to address health care costs and spreads the burden too much onto employers, and will certainly eventually start to see significant tax increases on middle-income New Yorkers. And I believe that there are other things that we can do that will expand coverage to more New Yorkers and make healthcare more affordable so that more New Yorkers have access to care.
Mike Sportello of The Nation reports that Governor Andrew Cuomo himself just last year quipped that the New York Health Act would double everybody's taxes. So that's a Democrat in the governor's office. Is he wrong?
Not only is he wrong, I'm really actually sad to hear him say that. I think it's really easy to view this issue as a purely fiscal one. I think it was evident in our opening statements we talked about our patients first, our need to come first. It's our children, it's our brothers, it's our sisters, it's our parents, it's our patients. They need to come first when we have this conversation. Having said that, the fiscal implications are important. And instead of talking about the taxes as a whole, I think a more honest and direct way to talk about this issue is to talk about how it actually affects the individual. Because although it is true that we would raise taxes to do this, what we would be doing is eliminating all premiums, copays, and deductibles to do this. So to say that we're increasing taxes by billions of dollars is only half the story. We're decreasing people's premiums, copays, and deductibles by billions as well. In fact, 95% of New Yorkers actually save money. I'm going to say that again, 95% of New Yorkers. So if you make less than $300,000 per year, which is the vast majority of New Yorkers, you actually come ahead. And if you pay more than $300,000 a year, we thank you for how productive your taxes will be for the rest of us, because everybody's taxes go in and everybody gets health care as you come out. Everybody pays a little in, everybody gets their health care out. And I think that's specific point I want to make to Governor Cuomo, is that it's easy to be blasted on headlines of governor raises taxes and all he wants to do is win the next election. What I want to have is a more complicated conversation where we talk about the impact on our children and our families.
Okay. Greg, you brought up some of the numbers. You want to respond to what you just heard there?
Absolutely. First, can I ask where that 95% number came from?
Yeah. So there's three economic studies on the New York Health Act. There's the RAND report, which is the middle-of-the-line study I just cited. And then there's a left-leaning and a right-leaning one that that both have problems in. But the middle-of-the-line nonpartisan report, the RAND report study, estimates that about 95% of families will save money.
The RAND report, I would agree, is the most middle of the road of the three, I'd say, principal studies on the issue. The RAND report, in getting those numbers, does take some pretty big assumptions on containing the cost of this program. Mike mentioned something else. He talked about the elimination of copays, elimination of deductibles, the elimination of out-of-pocket costs. The New York Health Act doesn't really mirror other single-payer or government-sponsored plans across the world in that respect. To completely eliminate all these cost-sharing features is really out of line with what we've seen in Canada and the UK, and that's why this is just such an astronomically expensive plan, and it has just some fatal flaws in it. Absolutely fatal flaws. To fund it, it relies upon a Medicaid waiver from the federal government, which has never happened in the history of this country. I think it's worth about $50 billion of the cost.
Gottfried has said, Assemblyman Gottfried has said, that yes, they would like to see that waiver happen. And right now, that climate with Washington is not likely, but this can happen without it.
I question that. Also, the RAND report is a year and a half old, maybe.
No,
a little less than a year.
A little less than a year.
August last year.
It doesn't contemplate long-term care.
That's not true. There is an adjustment for long-term care in it.
In that the has been updated
analysis,
to adjust for long-term care. Long-term care, well, the numbers I said earlier in the cost did not consider long-term care.
Do we know what long-term care is? Do you know what that is?
Yeah.
Okay. So what that is, just to make sure everyone, all the listeners know what that is to make sure that our people, our fellow citizens with disabilities and our older people and people with special needs are able to get the care that they need throughout life. I argue that's healthcare, and I also believe healthcare is a human right. And the fact that the current state of New York doesn't make sure that we're taking care of our elderly, taking care of our fellow citizens with disabilities, to me, that's the atrocity, not the fact that, you know, we have to spend a little bit more money on these issues. The atrocity right now is that those people are going without needed care today and will go without it tomorrow and the next day until we pass the New York Health Act.
It's not a little bit of money. It's the largest tax increase ever contemplated at the state level. Other states have gone down this road. Vermont and California have made it, I think, the furthest. Pete Shumlin in Vermont ran on the issue.
A Democrat
ran on the issue. It passed both houses. It came to his desk. And the tax increases upon everyday Vermonters simply made it unconscionable for him to sign.
But, you know, I think people have to understand that it's not a tax increase in isolation. It's elimination of all other health care costs and a saving for 95% of New Yorkers. It's also a saving for business owners. Those who already provide insurance will be paying less than they do now.
And
that's part of the RAND analysis. And the thing about the RAND analysis is it's independent. They're not New Yorkers. They have no interest
But a lot of the taxing structure in the bill is yet to be determined. One of the few things is 80% will be paid by employers. 20% will be paid by employees. That's the payroll tax aspect. 80% by employers, 20% by employees.
And the 80% of employers who already have paid in the past, because that's the calculation in the report, they will be paying less than they do now. That's part of the analysis. I mean, it's a huge report.
And there are other analyses that don't come to that conclusion.
Right, but we both agreed this was the most middle-of-the-line one, not the far left and not the far right one, right? We agreed on that in the beginning of the hour.
It's
an independent analysis. I don't deny that.
It sounds to me like Greg thinks that they're making some big leaps in assumptions.
It says right in the report they're making some big leaps in assumptions, which, I mean, the academic reports do. They have to in certain cases.
But let me ask Michael Crocker, who's executive director of Unshackle Upstate. When Dr. Cavey, Michael, says, look, even the concern raised by the business community, you ought to welcome this, that there are gains to be made even on the business side. Clearly, business leaders on this program, and largely speaking, and again, I don't want to speak monolithically, but largely speaking, don't believe that. Michael, do you believe what you're hearing there? I mean, like, are you swayed at all?
Listen, I think there are no doubt there are businesses that have concerns about being in the insurance space, but I think that there are plenty of things we can do to support that. But I also think we need to step back and say, what is our goal here? I think our goal here is to allow as many New Yorkers as possible to have quality health insurance. And right now, I think it's important to state that 95% of New Yorkers currently have coverage. So what we're really talking about trying to do is to close that 5% gap and expand coverage to all New Yorkers. Many of those, about half of them, are currently Medicaid eligible or have access to state subsidies to get insurance. So to deal with a policy that has about $250 billion in new taxes and might jeopardize over 150,000 jobs to close a gap of 5% of New Yorkers, I just don't think is the most responsible approach. I think there are plenty of things that we can do to expand access that don't have the serious tax increases and job losses that the New York Health Act brings.
Dr. Cavey, you want to respond to that? Go ahead.
Well, I think that's the problem. The assumption that if you have insurance, everything is fine is simply not true. Most people think their insurance is great until they need it. And that's when you realize how much it costs.
So this is actually an important point that I think we at least need to see if there's any common ground here. Because one of the things Michael Crocker just said was that, you know, everyone agrees the goal is to insure as many people as possible. That's not what Mike Sportello said. Mike said the goal is for everyone to have health insurance, for no one to have these hard calls. And so when you look at the actual status quo, I'm curious to know what our guests, and then we'll take some of your phone calls. And David and Pittsford, hang there, and we've got emails to read. But when you look at the status quo, we had the guy who basically wrote the Affordable Care Act on this program a month ago, Jonathan Gruber. And I asked him, if you have a $6,000 deductible, do you really have health care? Because I know a lot of people who do not go to the hospital or don't go to get a procedure because it's going to be $3,800. And they are paying for every penny of that, or it's going to be $5,400. And if you have $6,000 deductible, what you really don't have is healthcare. What you have is catastrophic care. You know, but catastrophe is a different thing for every family. And so, but Gruber says yes. Gruber said in the past you could get dropped, and he was on this program. I'm telling you exactly what he said. He said yes, because in the past you could get dropped by your insurance after an injury or an illness, and all of a sudden you've got a $100,000 bill, and now you are it's over. Whereas, okay, and in Gruber's words, most people could deal with a one-time shock of $6,000. Mm-hmm. Well, how many people are dealing with that? More than 40% of this country now that has private health insurance has a deductible of around that range, about $6,000. So it's called high deductible. That number has gone way up in just the last 5 years. And that's where we are under the Affordable Care Act. So I assume, Dr. Cavey, you think the status quo, no good in that way.
I mean, that's absolutely the case. There's no question about it. In fact, a recent study from the Kaiser Foundation looking at their population of patients, all insured, showed that half of the patients who have diabetes do not take their insulin regularly because they cannot afford it. It falls into the deductible category.
Okay. Mike, what do you think of the status quo in that regard here?
I can speak from personal experience working in the clinics that the status quo is unacceptable. I'm very privileged. I work over at Strawn Memorial Hospital, and I have good insurance. And a lot of the people that I get to take care of that trust me with their care don't. It's very common that I have to work through with the physicians I get to work with medicines that are more cost effective. We run a health clinic out of Methodist Church on Thursday nights for people without insurance. And most of their health care needs stem from conditions that if they were better treated, they wouldn't have in the first place. We're talking about complications from diabetes. We're talking about the inability to afford proper nutritional food because they're spending so much money on prescription drugs. These are problems that the New York Health Act fixes, but because we don't have the courage to act on behalf of 95% of New Yorkers because we're scared of a tax increase, we are not passing the important New York Health Act to protect our children and families. And one more point. The deductibles we're talking about, I think it's easy to think of ourselves. Most kids in this country are on family plan deductibles. And so we're talking about these deductibles affecting our children. So to say that 97% of children are insured, not even to talk about the 3% that are not, but to talk about the 97% of children that are insured, many of them are on these high deductible family plans.
Greg Barilla, the status quo, is it good health insurance in the state?
I don't believe so. No, we can certainly make improvements. I will say a poll was done by Ciena that said 54% of New Yorkers are satisfied with their current coverage. I'm not saying 54% is an overwhelming number, but 54% is a majority.
It's a majority, yeah.
And the cost of healthcare and the cost of insurance are huge, huge problems. In New York State, we add $6.1 billion in taxes right now onto private health insurance. It's largely in the form of a thing called HCRA, the Healthcare Reform Act. It was enacted under Governor Pataki. It was intended at the time to provide a source of funding for struggling hospitals and at-risk communities. There is now a federal pot of money under the ACA that addresses that concern in some similar fashion. And now HCRA still exists. It still grows because it becomes a spending slush fund for New York State. Obviously, we have taxes on our health insurance. We have an immense amount of mandates on our health insurance in New York State. In New York State, it's a litigator's paradise. We don't have any significant, we haven't had any significant medical malpractice reform to control the cost of care. These are all solutions that I think most people can agree with that, to get to Mike's point, help us move in a direction of getting more affordable insurance, more accessible insurance to that last 5% of New Yorkers who are uninsured. We have a 95% insured rate in this state. We can work on ways to improve the insurance
with private health insurance.
Private health insurance with Medicaid, with Medicare, I mean, with the entire blended system.
Yeah.
We have 95%.
Because I suspect Mike and Dr. Cavey no longer think private insurance is viable in this state or country.
That's the problem.
It's viable if you make a ton of money, and I think that the vast majority of New Yorkers don't make enough money to have meaningful health insurance. Half of the insured population are underinsured. Those are people with high deductibles, as you called it, catastrophic care.
Go ahead, Michael.
I think it's important to state that under the New York Health Act, it's not just that you're offering additional options for insurance, you're outlawing private insurance. I think a lot of New Yorkers want to see insurance expanded to as many New Yorkers as possible, want to see every New Yorker have coverage. But I think a lot of New Yorkers will be very concerned to find out that the current healthcare program that they have is going to be outlawed, and you no longer have access to your private health insurance, and you're going to go instead onto a state-sponsored plan. I think for many New York families, that's going to raise some serious considerations when you put New York State in charge of your health insurance.
And I think that's an understandable concern. When we passed the Affordable Care Act a few years ago, we told people that these plans are going to be great. They're, you know, these plans are going to be the best in the world. They're going to add a patient's bill of rights in there. Everything's going to be covered. And what actually we did was we passed a few good things, like made sure that delivery was covered, made sure emergency services were covered. But then we gave control back to the for-profit health insurance companies and said, do what you want. Put whatever in the plan that you want to, figure it out. Patients will choose what they want. And as it turned out, when you have for-profit healthcare companies making decisions on what is and what is not covered, they just do what's best for their bottom line. That's their job. They're a business. Why do that when you can pass the New York Health Act and you have everything that's medically necessary covered? If it's currently covered by Medicaid, Medicare, or medically necessary, it will be covered by the New York Health Act. It will not be decided by the for-profit health insurance companies.
New York State largely has a not-for-profit health insurance market, particularly in upstate New York, is largely not-for-profit. So that I don't know that calling it, especially in this community, a for-profit market is exactly accurate.
I think the word not-for-profit, I think, be a little confusing. So the Excel CEO makes millions of dollars, and he received a double-digit percentage raise the last 2 years. So I think whether they are legally identified as 501c3s or whether it is a small group of people that make tons of money off of a community of people that are largely uninsured, I think the story is pretty clear when you hear how much CEOs are making off of our uninsured patients.
Let me grab.
He had a 13% increase in his salary to $2.3 million a year, as the CEO of a health insurance company.
To administer a very complex health administration company, that we would then transfer to New York State. I don't know the last time anyone's been to the DMV, but I don't know if you want to have them handling your health care and your health insurance. And
that's funny.
You
Medicare,
can't tell me you can't.
Sorry, go ahead.
Medicare is different. You can't tell me that that's not a possibility. You look at the VA, which is sort of an example in this country of a system in this nature. And I'm not saying anything about the care of VA. I've talked to veterans. They seem to really appreciate the care they receive.
It's the most popular health insurance in the country, and second is Medicare.
But there is an endless stream of issues, I don't want to say scandals, of problems with VA administration that is largely from the bureaucratic administration of it. We are going to import that to every single New Yorker's health insurance and health care in New York.
To the extent that everybody on this panel is going to want to jump on that point, but that's what David in Pittsburgh has been kind of waiting to kind of offer to the group here. So go ahead, David. I know you kind of want to piggyback on that idea. Go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I experienced the NHS with my son in England, and the service was absolutely wonderful, no waiting, and just great. And then when I asked to pay the bill, they told me they didn't have a billing office, so I couldn't pay it. Aside from the fact that insurance executives are making $2.4 million and Excellus is considered to be one of the most efficient in the country, we have hospital administrators who are routinely making over $1 million a year. We have doctors who come out of school with huge student loans, and they're paying high interest rates to the banks. So we have high costs associated with that. And then, most of all, the thing I'm really concerned about is in New York State, when there's a big pot of money around, it seems like we cannot manage that without all kinds of theft and graft. And even though Cuomo's cronies are on trial or in jail or whatever, and if we clean it up, it's going to go that way again. We don't have safeguards that will protect us. So I think the goal of something like the NHS would be wonderful. We've demonstrated an inability to have such a thing.
Okay. That's from David. I'll ask all of our guests what's wrong. Mike, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
I think what the NHS gets, something's right and something's wrong. What it gets right is it makes sure every single person in the UK gets the healthcare they need. Every single citizen is guaranteed access to healthcare. That's something that every country does, in the every industrialized country in the world does, except for the United States. We're the only country with a large uninsured population. What it does differently than what the New York Health Act would suggest is that all the doctors there are employed by the government. That's actually not true under the New York Health Act. So you still have private practice doctors, hospital doctors, everything else would still not be employed by the government. None of that would change. Only who pays them. Under the New York Health Act, it'd be paid by the government, and all the doctors and everything like that would be in-network. The problem with the Affordable Care Act is that they allowed for-profit private health insurance companies to decide who was in or out of network. Under the New York Health Act, there's only one network, and everybody's in it.
Okay, but Dr. Cavey, I see you nodding, but he's talking about, the caller is talking about New York State's history, and he's saying, you're adding a large bureaucratic arm here. And we have a history of hiding money, stealing money, all kinds of corruption, and that all he sees is a ripe ground for more corruption.
Well, of course, there could be corruption, and it is a bureaucracy, and there's no question that those are issues. But having seen the Canadian healthcare system up close since I grew up in Canada, and that's an enormous system, I really think that there is no other future for healthcare than universal health care.
What
system.
Is different in Canada and then Albany? I mean, does something happen when
Canadians
people go to Albany?
Canadians are such wonderful people.
Yes. Yeah. I grew up in Buffalo, so I can affirm. Yeah.
Michael Crocker, what do you make of David's call there, his concerns?
Well, I think to David's final point here, you're going to put our entire health insurance industry on the backs of a New York State bureaucracy. I mean, I don't know how many New York State bureaucracies we can rattle off that are complete and total boondoggles. Maybe it's a New York State flaw, but it is part and parcel of state government here in New York, is an inability to effectively manage large programs. You know, I don't want to compare apples to oranges, but, you know, the management of the state MTA system or the thruway system. State Medicaid. I mean, these are serious issues, and you're going to have to transition our existing infrastructure, healthcare infrastructure, over to the state of New York, which the transition there alone is going to be complete chaos. And in the process, you're going to eliminate over 150,000 direct jobs, to say nothing of the spinoff jobs that these industries support. And that's a larger job loss than we lost in the Great Recession. So you're going to completely upend the New York State economy, of which our current system ranks 49th out of 50. And then trust the New York State bureaucracy to somehow efficiently and effectively manage healthcare for all New Yorkers. I think that's a huge gamble, and I think New Yorkers are going to be very concerned when they find out that that's the direction New York State's trying to head.
Greg Barilla.
To some of these points, this is why the New York Health Act, it's just not a viable path forward. So they brought up the UK system, we brought up the Canadian system. Those systems do not outlaw private insurance. Private insurance still exists to some extent. There's wraparound coverage, there is, I believe, dental and eye coverage. So right there, you have a cross control because you're sharing some with
the... But the New York Health Act does not outlaw private insurance either, right?
Sure it does.
Yeah, it does.
Yes, it does.
Sure it does.
It outlaws duplicative. So, for example, if you wanted, like, supplemental cosmetic surgery, you could buy insurance for, like, cosmetic surgery.
Okay.
It goes far beyond, and it doesn't really look like what these two, the program in UK looks like, or the program in Canada.
So you're saying those aren't good analogs?
There's one country on the planet that essentially has a healthcare structure that mimics the New York Health Act. That's Belarus. Other than that, the European structure, the Canadian structure, they're very different. And I'm not saying there's not similarities to the New York Health Act, but we're pointing to systems that have cost controls within them, cost controls that do different things. They cost people more money. They ration care in certain cases. There is different things, ways they control costs. There are none of these cost controls. We have no residency requirements for this. You can come into New York and be on this plan the next day. What we were talking about.
That's not true.
Sure it is.
The residency requirements aren't spelled out in the bill, but that doesn't mean that you could come here and then one day later be under the plan. That's not true.
Well, it can be inferred.
Okay. That's not true for our state college system. That's not true for any other residency requirement. That just isn't true.
Can I ask a little bit about jobs too? Because Michael Crocker's concerned about job loss, and I saw you, Dr. Katie, you were shaking your head. You don't agree with the job loss numbers?
Oh no, there will be job losses. There is no question about that. But built into the New York Health Plan as it stands now, for the 80,000 who are estimated to lose their jobs, are immediate financial benefits and retraining, with the intent of helping those people move to another job.
And the people,
they're skilled labor.
And she's referring to the individuals that work for the for-profit health insurance companies. So these companies employ people, for example, accountants and other people that work for the health insurance company that go home to their families just like the rest of us at the end of the day, and they're just trying to earn a living for their families. And it's really sad to see that, you know, they might not have a job if this were to go through. Having said that, like she said, wouldn't it be great if our money we're spending in healthcare isn't going towards administering this giant, wasteful, for-profit healthcare industry, and instead we're spending that money on more nurses, more doctors, and giving people jobs that are actually helping people, not just wasting everybody's time and money? To me, I think that's a much better way to employ people.
Go ahead, Michael Crocker.
If you're talking, you know, you're saying you're going to retrain all these people to do what? If what Mike is saying is we don't need these people, and then you're also saying you're going to retrain them, what are these people doing? So, you know, you're going to go ahead and replace our current healthcare system, displace over 150,000.
No, I don't know where you're getting that number. The estimated number, and this is in multiple analyses, is maximally 80,000.
I disagree, and I don't even think that number takes
into account. Where did that number come from?
The 150,000 is from an Evick Roy study.
The Evick Roy study? The Evick Roy study? So to be clear to our listeners at home,
the listeners have no idea what you're talking about, but go ahead.
The Abbott-Roy study is a conservative analysis by a former staffer of a few different institutions. And what it makes several assumptions to purposefully degrade the value of the analysis, and I'll point a couple out. The first thing it does is it assumes we continue to it assumes we get no waivers, and it assumes that we continue to pay the money.
We're not going to get waivers.
And that's just one small thing. And it continues to assume that we continue to pay for Medicare and Medicaid and New York Health. Obviously, we wouldn't do all three, and that's just a purposeful lie that they wrote into that by that right-leaning think tank to degrade.
So you're currently not going to get a waiver, though.
There are legal workarounds to that Assemblyman Gottfried and a number of other lawyers on his team have said that we are able to do.
I mean, you want to talk about assumptions. I think that is an assumption.
But you're not going to talk about how the Abbott-Roy study purposefully lied to people?
I want to say that 150,000 number appears in the RAND study that we're all citing.
RAND estimated 60,000. I have it right in front of me.
Okay, so 60,000, 80,000, 150,000.
Still a lot of jobs.
It's a lot of jobs.
I'm not trying to minimize
tens of thousands of jobs.
And it's jobs related to the healthcare administration, healthcare world, financial services. It does not contemplate, and I don't know that any study accurately can, trickle down to members like mine, who if they're... when their healthcare costs go up and there are a mobile business, which small businesses can be in certain cases, do they leave this state? We have seen an exodus of employers from upstate New York. That's unquestionable. And that is largely because of the burdens placed on them from New York State. This would be another burden placed on them by New York State. So there is real concern that I think everyone has to share that would continue under, again, the largest tax increase ever contemplated on a state level in the history of the United States.
I have to get our only break of the hour. We've got a lot more listener feedback to share. And as we go to break, I'll read an email from a listener named Dave who says, Evan, I'm listening with interest from Canada. I moved to Canada from Ithaca to Kingston, Ontario in late 1995 to take a job there. I was very pleasantly surprised when I got my first paycheck there. Yes, my taxes per se were higher than they were at Cornell, but I didn't have a health insurance premium other than a double-digit charge for prescription drugs and dental care once every two checks. Thus, the percent deducted was several percent lower than I was used to paying, and now I didn't have copays and deductibles either. I was very pleased, and I remain pleased, having lived in Canada for some 22 years now. Now, how New York would wisely make the switch on their own is another question, of course. And that is from Dave, writing to us from Canada. We appreciate that, and that's sort of the point that Greg Berla was making. He doesn't see it as a perfect analog, but a lot to kind of sort through as we talk about the merits or otherwise of single-payer health care and the New York Health Act. This coming Tuesday, the New York State Senate will hold hearings on that. And advocates for single payer say now is the time. They believe that for the first time in almost 30 years, this state can get serious about this and maybe get it done. And that's why Mike Sportello is here, co-chair of the Rochester Campaign for New York Health. And also with the campaign is Dr. Ray Allen Cavey, a retired pediatric cardiologist. Also with us here, Greg Brula, the state director for NFIB. Michael Crocker is executive director of Unshackle Upstate, sharing their concerns about the New York Health Act. More of your feedback after our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, on Memorial Day. In our first hour, a special report from the Marketplace team called Brains and Losses, the bottom line on aging and financial vulnerability. In our second hour, a re-air of a conversation we think you ought to hear, especially on Memorial Day. Author Jeff Spivak on his new book, 22 Minutes, telling the story of a local sailor, carpenter, and Navy veteran who survived the worst defeat in U.S. Navy history. This is Connections. Dan writes to us to say single payer would ideally be federally legislated. He says single payer is not going to happen nationally, given that Medicare for All is supported by a majority of Democrats, independents, and even a slight majority of Republicans, making it one of the most popular policy proposals in the country. Why won't it happen nationally? In my opinion, it's clearly being obstructed by the Democratic Party first and foremost. And so Dan goes on to say he thinks Democrats are largely culpable for the fact that we haven't seen single payer either nationally or in the state level. But he does go on to kind of make the point here that if we are going to see single payer, he understands the debate at the state level. Why aren't we seeing this really more seriously on the national level? That's where it needs to be. So what happens, Mike? What happens if Democrats are very successful in the next election cycle? And we're starting to see a lot more momentum for Medicare for All or some other flavor of single payer. But New York State's already kind of created this transition, and that's on the way. Does that make it smoother to kind of lock in with what's happening nationally, or does that make it sort of bulky and awkward? What's going to happen?
I think New York State could serve as an excellent model for the nation. It's really sad that – so New York State, as a history of New York State, has done a lot for our children and our families in terms of health insurance, much more than a number of other states. I grew up in Wisconsin, and I can say that New York State does a better job of making our families are insured than Wisconsin. It'd be great to see Medicare fall at the national level. However, it unfortunately is not going to happen anytime soon. The number of co-sponsors in the House continue to grow, and that's really exciting to see. And the number of co-sponsors in the Senate is only 16. And there are no Republicans, and most Democrats do not support it in the Senate. So unfortunately, it's not happening anytime soon at the federal level. And so we need to protect our New York families today and pass the New York Health Act.
Okay. You want to add to that, Dr. Kidman?
Can I just add something small, which is that the Canadian healthcare system began with a single province. The province of Saskatchewan went first, and at the time, the premier of that province said, "I predict that we will have all of Canada will have a national system within 10 years." It was within 5 years. So I think there's a well-established path to go from a single entity to a federal level.
Go ahead, Greg.
If you can predict the politics of this country in the next 5 to 10 years, after the last 5 to 10 years, you are a smarter person than I am.
Look, there's the first thing that everyone has agreed
yep.
upon.
But in New York State, we are the arguably the least competitive, economically speaking, state in the nation. Certainly on a short list.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. The
least
what?
Economically competitive in New York State, particularly in upstate New York. If we go it alone and we become the only state to add this tax burden and this cost burden onto our state budget, onto the backs of our employers, including my members' small businesses, onto the backs of Joe taxpayer, you will see a continued economic decline. I think that's unquestionable. So we have debated the jobs numbers. The jobs numbers in every study, correct me if I'm wrong, generally consider healthcare-related industries, financial services, administration. They do not consider that next layer of employment, small businesses, supply chain providers to the healthcare industry, particularly in upstate New York, where, sad to say, Bethlehem Steel isn't still rolling iron on the shores of Lake Erie and Buffalo, and Kodak's not what it once was here. And that's true up and down the thruway corridor. What have we replaced that with? We've replaced it largely with the generic term Eds and Meds. We have a healthcare-driven economy. If we disrupt and basically outlaw portions of that economy, what does that do for Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse? I think it's a pretty frightening thing.
So in your opinion, you think that the New York economy would be better if we're putting money back in the people's hands?
Get a little closer to that microphone.
Pardon me. Go ahead. You think, in your opinion, that right now the taxes of the New York Health Act or something as big as that would be bad for New York State because there's less money in each family's hands?
I think more than doubling and in some cases tripling our state budget and our state the revenues necessary via taxes. Yeah, I do think that would.
Because 95% of New Yorkers would have more money in their pocket
again,
after they don't
have
to pay premiums or deductibles.
We keep going back and forth on these studies. That RAND study, which I've cited too, it says in its first line it's based on a series of assumptions, just like most studies are, but that 95% number is based on a series of assumptions
that
providers would take less.
That number is intact in all the analyses. That it would cost less, except for the far right analysis, the leftward leaning analysis that came first. They said 98% of New Yorkers would pay less.
The Friedman study?
There's no other way to do a study like this than with assumptions, because you cannot project yourself into the future to get the actual
it's
numbers.
Assumed. Go on, Michael.
Yeah, go ahead, Michael.
I mean, if I can just put a number that Greg cited into some perspective here, we're talking about over $300 billion to in cost for this program. The current state budget is $175.5 billion. That is a massive increase in state spending in order to fund this program. There's a reason why you would say New York is going to be a leader in this. It's because every other state that's tried to do this has failed and abandoned the effort. And I don't think, and it's the reason probably why there are a number of members of the Democratic Conference who are shy about taking on this fight, I don't know that New York State could successfully pull off this effort. And I think there's a real concern about blowing up the system, more than doubling our state budget, and failing. And I think the record has shown that when a state tries to take this on at an individual level, that's the end result. And I don't think that some responsible folks in Albany want to wear that. And I don't blame them.
All right. I want to take more phone calls because you guys have touched off a lot of feedback. Bruce in Irondequoit is next. Go ahead, Bruce.
He talks about handing over this to a bureaucracy. I'm wondering what he thinks we deal with now. We deal with two sides of a bureaucracy. Second, I won't be spending the money for the health care. If I'm paying in taxes, what do I care as long as the result is better health care and less cost? And Saskatchewan can do it and New York can't? I just don't see how that can. You have to start somewhere. And if it's us, let's lead, let's do it.
Okay. Bruce, thank you for the phone call. And so before I kick it to the panel, Peter writes kind of a similar idea. Because what Bruce is saying there is, if you want to say you're worried about bureaucracy, we have a lot of bureaucracy with insurance companies now. Peter writes to say, I'm curious why there is more of a focus on why state-run healthcare isn't perfect than how even an imperfect system would compare to the current one. True, we may have some possibility of corruption, but don't we already have that in prescription costs and practices by pharmaceutical and insurance companies now? If we expand coverage to everyone, instead of most or some, isn't that the actual goal? So Peter and Bruce are making similar points there, and Greg Barilla, does that land with you at all there, that we have a lot of bureaucracy now, we have a lot of corruption now. Maybe it takes a different flavor, but you're not going to create a perfect system. It doesn't exist.
I mean, I don't know how much corruption per se we have in the private insurance market or the not-for-profit insurance market. And certainly, yeah, there's hospital bureaucracy, there's insurance bureaucracy. We've talked about this today, that the system is not perfect. I still would not compare that level of bureaucracy to what we see in New York State government. Just go to your local DMV. Pick up a newspaper, read about issues with child protective services in counties across this state. Medicaid is the most fraudulent program we have in New York State, and it is a healthcare related program. We would extend these issues to every single New Yorker. To Michael's earlier point and something we discussed before, we have coverage rates in the state at 95%, and I'm not denying there is an underinsured issue as well. There are strategies and solutions that we can all pursue that Governor Cuomo himself put in this budget this year. He put forward a commission that was to study how to close this hole of 4 to 5%. It would include things like, and there's a bill that Assemblyman Gottfried and Senator Rivera introduced recently that would allow illegal undocumented immigrants to receive coverage. That addresses some of the problem. We could do there's some marketing efforts into underserved communities. Subsidies for people who don't qualify for Medicaid, but private insurance is a little too expensive or too expensive to utilize. I'm not saying this is all the solutions. I'm not saying there aren't, that any of them is even a solution, but Governor Cuomo tried to put together a panel, a task force, whatever you want to call it, to explore these. It was denied by the legislature. And I think we're pursuing this fantasy instead of actual real solutions that can help people.
This is a real solution that can help people.
It can't be
this
afforded.
This is a real solution that can help people.
It can't be afforded.
Canada does it every day.
Vermont and California couldn't.
One state, Vermont, that is in vastly smaller than New York
it's
State.
It's roughly the size of Monroe County.
Monroe County is not trying to have a single-payer system.
And it's not one state. California is the most similar state
California
to New York.
California is like 3 votes away from passing that.
California has not abandoned this.
Well, one of its lead sponsors, and I can quote him, but I mean, he said the bill was woefully unprepared. It didn't accurately account for cost. It didn't have any controls for cost. And it's the exact same problems we have with the New York Health Act. And again, I keep going back to it. New York Health Act relies on $50 billion from a federal waiver. That's not going to happen.
That is not true. It does not rely on that. As we've said over and over, there are legal workarounds.
What are they?
I'd be interested.
I mean, you're just taking something like Godfrey's
word? I'll tell you right now what they are. So what the waivers would do would be allow us to do the New York Health Act perfectly as written. Without the waivers, what we would do is at the doctor's office, so where the clinics that we work at, we would bill the New York State, and New York State would then bill the quote-unquote true payer. So in a single-payer system, the doctor, you come to the doctor, I bandage up your wound, I bill New York State. Under the system where if we were not to get the waivers, you come to the doctor, I bill New York State, and New York State bills Medicare at the federal level.
So why isn't that just in the bill?
Why would that be in the bill? Why would you do that when we can get the waivers? We can do, I mean.
Because you can't get the waivers.
We just said we don't need the waivers. I don't think anybody would. But
Evan, also, I mean, let's fundamentally understand, we have a significant out-migration problem in the state of New York, particularly in upstate. But what is that going to do to the cost of this program when you have a state where you have a million people?
Michael Allen writes to us, is asking, for all the people who have moved to Canada for single-payer health care, could you have people move to New York State? Could you have employers move to New York State for single-payer health care?
I hardly think that they would be interested in coming here to be under a significantly bureaucratic system. But to my earlier point, a lot of the assumptions on this are that the highest income earners in New York State are going to fund this. What happens when some of those very, very wealthy people that the governor's already talking about being chased out of the state start leaving? When you have many billionaires in New York City who pay a significant portion of this state's income tax already, what happens when they decide that they don't need to be in Manhattan to work on Wall Street, and they move over to Connecticut or to Florida?
So let's ask.
That burden's got to be spread out amongst all New Yorkers, and that's when you're going to start to see significant increases on costs for middle-income New Yorkers.
No, I hear that, Mike.
The system can collapse under its own weight.
Let's ask Mike and Dr. Cavey that, because when it's Elizabeth Warren talking about a national plan, an ultra-millionaire's tax to fund different initiatives, the concern is maybe you're overestimating the revenue because people will try to offshore it. But generally speaking, it's harder to do that. Whereas in this state, Governor Cuomo himself is talking about moving your address. So all of a sudden, you're kind of hiding from what New York State is doing there. Are you worried about that?
That's a really good question. I'm not worried about it. I'll give you two pieces of evidence as to why. The first piece of evidence is that under Obamacare, a number of states either chose or chose not to expand Medicaid. And we saw almost no migration between states after that, even though Medicaid vastly improves people's lives. The second example is when she said Canada expanded province by province their Medicare for All style system. We did not see any vast migration between state province by province in Canada. So those are the two most direct recent examples we have, and we didn't see any real migration in either of those cases.
I'm going to steal. Go ahead, Michael. Got to keep it tight.
When you're really increasing the taxes on that highest income bracket, they are the most mobile amongst us. And when they get those taxes imposed on them and they leave, where does that cost go? It shifts down to more and more New Yorkers.
And it does
which
take
is ultimately
a relatively few number of them to move. Or if you lose a small slice of that tax base, you lose a huge chunk of the revenue.
Well, call me a crazy optimist, but I think some percentage of those people want to see things done right.
Donna writes,
and are willing to pay their share to have that happen.
So let me.
To Greg's point, it only takes a few to leave.
It only takes a few to step up.
All right. So Donna writes to say, I purchased my health insurance off the New York Health Insurance Exchange because I'm employed by a small business. I pay $425 a month for a plan with a $6,000 deductible. A few years ago, after a standard mammogram, I was informed by an imaging company that I needed additional testing. When I asked them how much it would cost, they said they could not tell me. How can we live in a capitalist economy and consumers aren't even given access to the actual cost of care? That's from Donna. That's sort of a separate issue, but boy, that is... That is a continued frustration among people that they don't even know what procedures are going to cost. And there is always I was going to say an excuse. I think that's a little uncharitable because we have had people who work in the systems. It can be hard, but that is a consistent frustration. In our last minute or so, Greg, 30 seconds, some final thoughts as we head into Tuesday with the hearings. Go ahead.
Thanks, Evan. Thanks for the guests who joined me today. I just want to get back to some of the points we brought on earlier. We have a 95% coverage rate in this state. We should be pursuing realistic, rational solutions to address the remaining 5%, not adding a tax burden that's equivalent to the highest tax in the history of the United States at any state level onto the burden of our state budget and our taxpayers. It will have a negative economic impact, and it will result in further devastation for upstate New York.
And Mike, final thoughts from you, Mike Sportello.
I
got to let Mike Sportello go there because we're about to run into the end of the time. Go ahead, Mr.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It was really nice to meet you, Greg and Michael. Final point I want to end on is think about the little girl I brought up. We talked a lot about big numbers and tax implications. That means very little when we're not taking care of our children and families. So if you're interested in signing up for this movement, if you're interested in making sure that we pass New York Health Act with no co-pays deductibles, go to nyhcampaign.org and sign the petition. We need your support now more than ever.
Okay, and Greg and Michael, where would you want people to learn more about what you're talking about as well, to be fair?
Realitiesofsinglepayer.com. It is a website that has a bunch of information from the tax implications to the cost of care, the quality of care implications. It's a good website.
And I would say that if you want to get in the weeds and think about the studies you had, there's multiple studies, and do your best to try to kind of suss out where they're coming from and what they're saying, because a lot have been kicked around today. I want to thank Greg Barilla, State Director of NFIB, Michael Crocker, Executive Director of Unshackle Upstate. Thanks to both of you for being here. Thank you. Mike Sportello, Dr. Ray Allen Cavey from the campaign, Rochester Campaign for New York Health. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank
Gary
you.
Puttup behind the glass. Megan Mack is the producer. Rob Braden is the engineer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a beautiful weekend.